And you chant that chant. Well, good evening. And you chant that chant, and you're sitting here. Seems like you're taking on a pretty big responsibility, doesn't it? For those of you who have sat here, and many of you have, it does seem like, well, a great privilege and a great responsibility. So I will endeavor to, you know, be responsible here on the Dharma seat. And the topic that I want to bring up tonight is really, I feel, the teaching of the Tathagata, the Tathagata's words. It's very, very close to that. And specifically, I'm going to focus on what was brought up in the first line of our chant tonight, in the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. The first line is, the teaching of thusness has been intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it, so keep it well. And maybe you have heard, like I have, that Zen practice is the practice of taking care of the teaching of thusness, and also communing with the teaching of thusness in our bodies and mind in Zazen. That's one description of what we're doing in Zazen, is we're taking care of the teaching of thusness. You know, coming into relationship with the teaching of thusness. And recently I had a little epiphany, not like a Kensho or something like that, which is a little enlightenment, but more like an aha, about the ancient roots of this teaching of thusness that I'm going to be talking about. So I'll bring that up, this little epiphany, I'll bring that up a little later, but first I'm going to talk about what this teaching is, or where it, a little bit about its meaning. The Sanskrit word, so that right there alerts you that this is an ancient teaching, because this thusness has a Sanskrit word, and Sanskrit, you know, is kind of still around, but not really. It's more like Latin, not really a living language that is spoken so much. But it was the language of many ancient sutras in India. So the Sanskrit word for the teaching of thusness, or for the word thusness, is tatata. Tatata. And it's the root of a word that you've probably heard if you've been around here for a little while. It's the root of the word Tathagata, which is an honorific name for the Buddha. And so as an honorific name for Buddha, it means the one who comes from and goes to thusness. The one who comes from and goes to ultimate reality. The one who comes from and goes to the truth, or the Dharma, who comes from the Dharma and preaches the Dharma. That's the tathagata. So the root tathata means truth or Dharma or ultimate reality or thusness or thus. So it means the idea that word is meant to convey is that it's meant to convey the idea of direct experience that is unmediated by conceptual elaboration. So it's experience that just is, hits the mind without any thought, and it's living in that realm of sense perception, including the mind, that is always directly coming to us, but that we often impose something on, some thought or some particularly like or dislike. But the idea of thusness is the idea of just taking in the raw experience and communing with the raw experience. I was communing during our zazen. There was a dove somewhere in that direction. And I know some people here have hearing problems, so maybe you didn't hear it. And the dove was very faint. Maybe it was sitting on the fence or something out there. But anyway, this sound was coming to me, you know, and I didn't have to think about it. I didn't have to, I did impose dove, right? So I did impose something, and this is what we do, you know. We have there's sound, but we have a habit of imposing something on it, like language. And when we do that, we create a little bit of separation between us and that thing. So this idea of thusness is the idea of no separation, just to receive what's coming. Dogen has a phrase that I like, that kind of could be a definition for tathata. He says, he may be saying this about zazen, but he's also saying it about tathata. It's unconstructedness in stillness. It's immediate realization. Unconstructed. So this, and it's associated with, you know, a common thing that we say about our sitting practice is, you know, the point or the effort within our sitting practice to be present, right? To be present with this body and mind. But I think this term thusness conveys something that a presence that is given to us, and is not, that we're not trying for. We're not trying for this presence. This is an unconjured presence. So that this term thusness is speaking to that kind of presence. I think Suzuki Roshi uses the word naturalness sometimes. Naturalness. So this it has that sense of naturalness. You know what I'm trying to say. So, unconjured, unmediated, untried for presence. And that this teaching of thusness is pointing out this possibility of a way of being. So we have actually two, you know, we chant in this Sangha, we chant two long poems of Chinese origin. The one that we chanted tonight, the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi by Dongshan. And we chant also what's called the Sandokai, or how we translate that these days is the harmony of difference and equality. And that text also starts by bringing up the teaching of thusness. It says, the mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. That's the first line of the harmony of difference and quality and equality. And West, in that case, when that poem was written, I want to say 8th century, West meant India, and East meant China. So, anyway, both these poems bring up the teaching of thusness. And Dongshan, who later wrote the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, certainly was aware of the previous poem, and he honors it in making his poem start by bringing up the teaching of thusness. And if this wasn't enough to convince you that this was an important teaching in our school, the compilers of the Book of Serenity, in the very first case, this is a book of Zen stories or Zen koans. In that book, the compilers of that book, who are later than both these two poems, but still in China, compiling these old Zen stories, they bring up the teaching of thusness as the very first case in the Book of Serenity. And this is a very well-known case, and you may have heard it before. It's very short, easy to read for you. One day, the world-honored one ascended the Dharma seat. Manjushri struck the gavel and said, clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. The world-honored one got down from the seat. That's the whole story. And I admit that when I first heard that story, I thought, what is the big deal? Nothing happens. He gets up in the seat and he gets down. So, but, you know, with now 5 decades of appreciation of this Zen way. I have an appreciation, a different appreciation, and a not so superficial appreciation of this story. When the Buddha ascended the seat, and Manjushri witnessed the Buddha ascending the seat, we know that he took our Zazen posture. He probably put his left foot on his right thigh and his right foot on his left thigh. He sat upright, slightly tucked his chin, and held his hands in this Samadhi Mudra. We see many images of the Buddha sitting like this. And so what Manjushri clearly observed was this posture, and for him that was enough. And I would submit that for us Zen students, it's also enough. Whether we can take, I can't take, you know, right foot on left thigh. I never could. Sit full lotus. Once I sat at Thasahara, once I sat one period, half lotus, and it took me about 5 minutes to get up from my seat. I never have been able to have the flexibility to sit that way. I used to be able to sit Burmese, but anyway. Now I sit in a chair, but it doesn't matter so much, I don't think. But maybe Manjushri sees me sitting, you know, maybe he's not quite as inspired. I don't know. But that's his problem. Now, we take this posture. When we take this posture, we learn from this posture. And we not only learn from it ourselves, we also learn by watching, seeing, like Manjushri did, other people take the posture. And when we see other people take the posture, we might be even more inspired than when we, because we really can't see ourselves take the posture, right? Not exactly. We can feel ourselves take it. But sometimes we walk into the Zendo and we see someone sitting, and it's really inspiring. It's really inspiring. Manjushri, I think he was really, he just was really impressed right at that moment to see the Buddha taking that posture. It was enough. It was enough to just witness that. But it's also true that, and this is part of the teaching. One of the aspects of the teaching of thusness is that it's always close. This is kind of an article of faith in our school, that the teaching of thusness is very close. It's always here. But nevertheless, we might not. We might not always hear Manjushri strike the gavel, you know, and say, clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. We might not always, you know, quite feel the awe of that, you know, the awe of that kind of perception. But, you know, Suzuki Roshi said, our practice is readiness. He talked about, he has one chapter, I think, in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, if I'm not mistaken, called Readiness. Or he talks about it at least in one chapter, if not more. And I think that is the ethos of Zazen, to be ready, to be always ready to hear Manjushri strike the gavel, to have Manjushri enter your, you know, sitting and see that the Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. But, you know, we shouldn't get too greedy for that, you know. But we might have an attitude of readiness. So when I thought about this today, I thought of this story that happened once about, I don't know, quite a few years ago anyway. Around this time of year, though, I was sitting in a restaurant, and there was a little girl and her mother sitting near me. And the little girl had on a fairy costume, a little fairy with wings, like maybe angel. I don't know. Maybe she was an angel or a fairy anyway. And a lady who was sitting near them, you know, very cute, right? Very cute little girl. And so lady sitting next to them said, "It looks like you're ready for Easter." And the little girl, without hesitation, said, "I'm ready for now." She was teaching the teaching of thusness. So I alluded at the beginning of the talk to the fact that I had a recent discovery of something about this teaching of thusness through my studies of the Avatamsaka Sutra, or the Flower Garland Sutra, with my teacher, Rev Anderson. We've been reading that sutra for a number of years now, and we will be probably reading it for a number of years more. But through this study, I learned that the essentials of the first case of the Book of Serenity are cribbed from the Avatamsaka Sutra 1,000 years before the Book of Serenity was written. And the incident occurs in the first chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra, which describes multitudes of celestial beings, bodhisattvas, gandharvas, yakshas, guardians of the Dharma, many other enlightening beings, and how and has them describing how they found their respective doors of liberation. And all of these beings, it's each time they come to one of these beings, they said, it says each of these beings is empowered by the Buddha. And one of these beings says, on page, if you want to look it up, 129 of the Avatamsaka Sutra in Thomas Cleary's translation, one of these beings says, "Observe the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus." He has quite a bit more, or she, I'm not sure, has quite a bit more to say about this observation and about how they entered, how they found the door of liberation, but that opening line is almost exactly the line from the first case of the Book of Serenity. So that was kind of a wonderful dharmic connecting teaching to see how, and I have heard, and I've seen other examples of this, Avatamsaka Sutra leaking into Zen teaching, which would really arise many centuries later and be cataloged in the Book of Serenity like 1,000 years later. So that was really interesting. But you could say, kind of getting towards the end of this talk, you could say that this teaching of thusness is Buddhism in a nutshell, referring, as I said, to kind of irreducible truth, to the essential matter, to ultimate reality. When things are thus, they stand out unique and alive, to quote a poem, another poem. The word, another word that's sometimes associated with the teaching of thusness is adamantine. Not a word that we use much these days, but it carries the meaning of perfect, of something where that nothing could be, to indicate that there's nothing that could be added to this thing to make it any better, nothing that could be taken away. It's just exactly perfect as it is. And of course, you know, this is the way that Tsugi Roshi talked about the teaching of thusness, as things as they is, or things as they are, things as they, you know, without our imposition of conceptual overlays. And so this is, this teaching is always there in the background. It's always there in the background of our practice, and to be, considered and informing our practice. And of course, seeing how much we deviate from that kind of perception. And but when we deviate from that kind of direct experiential knowing, that's valuable too. That's part of our process. That's part of the whole gestalt of Zazen, you know. And then we see that we have deviated, that we've launched into, you know, various byways and sideways and back roads, and then we come back and remind ourselves that the Dharma of the King of Dharmas is just so. That's another word or phrase. You know, just so. Kipling have some stories called just so stories. Just so. Yeah. So this is like a background inspiration for our practice. The poem, I'd like to end with the poem that adorns the first case of the Book of Serenity. Very wonderful poem, often quoted. It goes, it's only four lines. Very economical case, this first case of the Book of Serenity. The unique breeze of reality, do you see? Continuously, creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade incorporating the forms of spring, but nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. The unique breeze of reality, do you see? Continuously, creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring. But nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. Our Buddha, I see questions there about that last line. I'll try to address that before I'm done. But you know, Dushan is basically saying, you know, and also Shirto, and you know, they're basically saying that this ancient brocade was woven long ago, and it's still in perfect condition. This ancient brocade of the teaching of thusness is woven long ago, but it's still in perfect condition. But yet, the poem says, continuously creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring. So, you know, we have some responsibility, just like I said at the beginning, you know, I have responsibility when I sit up here. And, you know, we have some responsibility in our practice. Our practice is a practice of creation. It's a creative practice, right? It's a creative practice. And through our creative practice of Zazen, you know, we keep, you know, care. We keep good care of the ancient brocade. Which is what Dungshan asks us to do. Now you have it. You have this wonderful ancient brocade. Can you please take care of it? Please take care of it. So now, Manjushri's leaking, right? That this created some furrowed brows out in the audience here. You could say that Manjushri's leaking is our fondness for conceptual elaboration, for language, for like it wasn't enough for the Buddha to just get up on the seat. Manjushri had to point it out and say, clearly observe, the Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. There was a final point that I wanted to make. So despite our habits, our strong habit of conceptual elaboration, prapancha it's called in the old language, we have a fondness for that. But we also have the capacity to be inspired by the unique breeze of reality, by the teaching of thusness, this ancient brocade, which is ever whole and undivided, unconflicted, unimpeded, undeterred, the absolute integrity of things as they are. Just like the little girl said, I'm ready for now. Yeah. So we have that. We have that in us. You know, it takes some work to bring it out. It takes some effort to bring it out to the surface, to make it apparent to us. And we can get discouraged along the way. But nevertheless, we have these inspiring stories to remind us. Thank you very much. If you want to make some comments or questions, or yes, Clem.
Yes, Jim. Thank you for your talk. That was quite interesting. I don't know how far afield I'm going to run with this, but what came to mind as you were actually quite early on in your talk is that I encounter people from time to time when they find out I'm a Zen practitioner, that's like, well, what do you do? And I think you've kind of brought that together for me in that what I'm seeking here is the ever-present as opposed to the everlasting. Because my experience has been is that the everlasting is not present. So, thank you very much.
Thank you for that seeking.
Go ahead, hide your hand was before mine.
No, it's okay.
Wow, thank you, Jim. And this is my favorite teaching, the Song of the Jhelumir Samadhi. And I think one of the things that I appreciate about the whole song is that it's like practice instructions in a way, how to practice to awaken thusness. And so like when it says, the meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse, that's a practice instruction. And I've been surprised because if I just inquire rather than look for the explanation, like I'm asking a question basically, that if I really pay attention and sort of wait, but I have to pay attention, something comes that sort of opens everything up. But oftentimes I forget. You know, I'd made the inquiry, but I forget to listen. So that's just one of the many phrases, I guess. Just communing with the source, travel the pathways, embrace the territory, treasure the road. Those are all practice instructions that are communing with the invisible thusness, I guess, that's underneath everything. So anyway, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Todd.
Oh. He has a mic.
Thank you, Jim. I may have misheard this, but I had a question about the koan. And I think that I've heard it said that the Buddha stepped down from the throne because he felt Manjushri had gone too far, that it was a response to that rather than giving a talk as he had originally intended. And I don't know, is that accurate or is that one interpretation that makes sense?
Well, it could be, except then he would be doing something about Manjushri's leaking. He would be doing something, and I don't know that he would do anything like that, but that might embarrass Manjushri. I don't know, but I hadn't heard that interpretation. So that's it sounds like It sounds like the Buddha maybe being, if in that understanding, the Buddha being perhaps a little reactive or something, but maybe so.
Or maybe a teaching moment.
You know? Maybe so. I hadn't heard that.
Okay, just ignore me then.
I thought the Buddha getting down was to highlight the eventfulness of the non-event. That's my understanding. But anyway, I wasn't there.
I don't see hands online, but I'm looking.
Oscar's got the something there.
Thank you, Jim. Sometime during your talk, I'm not sure exactly when, but having to do with the hairbreadth's deviation, that that realization, oh, in Zazen, in the posture, oh, I guess I'm really trying to get something out of this effortless effort. Why is that? I thought this morning. Why is that? And it came to me, oh, Zazen is developing tolerance for the yawning pit. The yawning pit. Mm. There's a kind of fear of letting go all fabrication of what's going on, of really letting it all go. So that was interesting to me, and I think useful. The other thing I wanted to mention about the leaking is what came to mind was just to put it in literary form or verbal form is to stain it with defilement. So thank you very much for your compassion, which, like Manjushri, is to take on that defilement for the benefit of all beings.
Mm-hmm. I thought of saying something like that during the talk, but then I thought it would be obvious, so I'm glad it was.
Thank you.
I wanted to note tonight that there is a new disciple of the Buddha's way in priest robes with us tonight. His name is Michael Deneau, and is a longtime person who's come and gone from the Sangha at various points, and Saturday, he received what we call Shuke Tokudo, and he sewed one of these robes, which he's wearing, and received the precepts again, having previously received the precepts, but now as an ordained shaved head person. So great congratulations, Michael. And welcome to your appearance here as a priest. I went yesterday to, this is a digression, but I went yesterday to a little party that Michael offered for his friends to celebrate his ordination, and I had a very engaging conversation with a Christian minister who was there, and felt so we had so much in common, I was really encouraged by that, you know, that interaction, feeling our bond as, you know, people of the way in the broadest sense, It was very encouraging to me. So thank you for introducing me to that fellow who happens to be the minister of a church that's about 4 blocks from my house. Interestingly enough. And he has been for over 50 years. Quite a remarkable person. Anyway, digression, but just, it's wonderful to meet people like that and to meet, to have that kind of expansive experience of the way, of people of the cloth, as it were, So we're people of the cloth, and he was a man of the cloth as well. Thank you very much.